Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast of the New Books Network. My name is Sebastian Trull, your host, and today I'm talking to Professor Siri Erika Gülestad about her book The Theory and Practice of Psychoanalytic Therapy, Listening for the Subtext, which was published by Routledge in 2020. The book was co-authored with Professor Björn Chilimo, who sadly passed away 1 year ago at the age of 92. It is a great honor and a great privilege that Professor Gülestad has decided to follow the invitation to the program. She is Professor Emeritus of Clinical Psychology at the University of Oslo, Norway, as was Professor Chilimo, and she directed the Department of Psychology and the Clinic for Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy there. She is a training and supervising analyst of the IPA and former president of the Norwegian Psychoanalytic Association. In 2019, she was awarded the prestigious Sigourney Award for profoundly impacting the evolution and acceptance of psychoanalysis as a scientific discipline in Norway. Thank you for joining us, Siri, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's really good to have someone here from Norway. I think you're actually the first Norwegian analyst that we speak with. And I think what would be really interesting for the audience and for me personally is to hear a bit about the background of the book, what motivated the writing of it, and also maybe a bit about the psychoanalytic scene in Norway and how your formation in Norway brought about your thinking and the writing of this book.
Yes. Actually, the situation at the University of Oslo as concerns psychoanalysis is quite a special one, I would say, because the first professor of psychology in Norway, he was appointed a professor in 1928, I think. Harald Schjeldrup was his name. He was a brilliant man, several PhDs, doctoral degrees, and with a degree in philosophy, and he changed his professorship to psychology. And his great ambition was to integrate psychoanalysis with general psychology, you could say. So he wrote a book in 1928 called Introduction to Psychology, where Freud's theory of the defense mechanism, repression, so on, and dreams and so on, chapters on those psychoanalytic issues was placed together with the learning theories of Pavlov and other sort of academic psychological themes. So he was a psychoanalyst. That was the important point. Mm-hmm. So he was personal analysis in Germany, which the Norwegian psychoanalyst did at the time, And he was the founder of the Norwegian Psychoanalytic Society also. So this position of being a very respected academic professor and bringing psychoanalysis into the department. So that has been a tradition ever since. A very controversial one, I would say. There has been professors who had thought that this psychoanalytic discipline had nothing to do at the university. But Bjørn Killingmo, who is my co-author, as you said, he was, Schjeldrup was his teacher, and Killingmo was my teacher and my mentor, to say. He was 22 years older than me. And Killingmo sort of, his project at the university was to continue this, we call this the Schjeldrup tradition. Harald Schjeldrup is the name of the house where the Department of Psychology is. He created an internal clinic for dynamic psychotherapy, which Killingmo, I'm speaking of him now, and sort of to create a clinical clinical training within the psychology, the professional education of psychology, which is a 6-year in Norway. That's also specific, I think, because after 2002, universities in Europe usually are structured around a bachelor, master programs, but we succeeded together with medicine to have an exception from that, because we argued that professional psychology is an integrated, where clinical thinking has to be integrated from the first year. So like medicine and in Norway. So we have succeeded, and that has been my also my very important thing for me to try to, has been fighting all along. But we have succeeded in maintaining this psychoanalytic, psychodynamic. I mean, it's a broad psychoanalytic in a broad sense, not specifically one theory or something like that, but as an integrated part of the training of psychologists at the University of Oslo.
Right, right. So before we get into the specific theoretical background of the book, I would like to hear a bit more about the specificity of psychoanalysis in a university context, because I think that runs like a thread through the whole book. There's a certain sensibility to questions of efficiency, I'd say, efficacy, being aim oriented, and I would imagine that this is sometimes a very uneasy position for psychoanalysis in the university, and having to argue to have a sensibility for those questions. And I think you kind of solve the issue in the sense that in the book you make a differentiation between psychoanalysis as a culture and psychoanalytic therapy as a method of treatment. And I think that is a differentiation that to me seems born out of this exact position that you're in, right? Psychoanalysis in the academy. Could you say a bit more about that?
Yes, I would say that the main my main position or main the main thing is to look at psychoanalysis as a depth psychological method, which from the point of view of science, I would say that we have a method, depth, the therapy room, the analytic room, is our laboratory, if you want, I could say it like that,
right?
Where we get access to data, if you use that word from the research field, that are different from the data that are accessed by other kind of methods, like experimental methods and so on. So psychoanalysis is, and you said psychoanalysis as a treatment, and that is, of course, a very important question. But psychoanalysis is also, I mean, it covers three issues, doesn't it? The term psychoanalysis is both a theory of personality development and a theory of development of psychic suffering, or psychopathology, if you want, and then also a treatment. And I think that psychoanalysis as a theory of personality is a very important contribution to science.
Right.
And we have access to how traumas are structured, affected our memories, mechanisms like dissociation and repression, if you want. I mean, these we bring to the scientific world knowledge about the depths of the human mind, to say it like that. So that I feel that in my position as a professor at university, I have in a way all the way through been arguing with colleagues from other disciplines, people from developmental psychology or memory research or personality theory and so on. So there, where I think psychoanalysis needs to be in a dialogue, we have to hear what they say. But
right.
And that's the one hand, on the one hand, and on the other hand, we have to assert, bring forward what we specifically know about human mind and the unconscious, of course, the unconscious, and what all that implies.
Right.
I'm not sure if I have answered your question, really.
No, I think your answer perfectly leads us into my next question, because your focus on personality development is something that is very central to the book, I think, and to the theory and technique you put forward in the book. And you call that relational-oriented character analysis.
Mm. Mm.
Could you explain that the theory to us that's condensed in that term, relational-oriented character analysis?
Yes, I appreciate that question, because it's central in the book, as you said. Let's begin by the word character analysis, which is a term from Wilhelm Reich,
right.
As you know probably. Wilhelm Reich, he had to flee from Germany during the Nazi, and between, he was invited. He was a Jew, he was a psychoanalyst, and he was a communist. There was three reasons, I think, that he had to flee from Hitler. And
right.
He was invited by Schjeldrup to come to Norway. So he taught here and lectured and had patients here in Norway between the wars. He was controversial. He became, Schjeldrup didn't agree with him, but he nevertheless he influenced a whole milieu in Norway by his notion of character analysis, which, to say it shortly, if you say that Freud focused on how internal intrapsychic conflicts are expressed in symptoms and in dreams, and in paraphraxis and so on. Reich added to that by saying that conflicts are also expressed in the whole character.
Right.
Our attitudes, an arrogant attitude, a submissive attitude, and his focus that the character has a correlate in a way. It's also expressed in bodily postures. So you can read the mind in the body in a way. And this a Swiss-German colleague, Marianne Leutzinger-Bohleber, which is a close friend of mine, she has this concept of embodied memories and body and mind is very central to the way she and other thinks. So it's in a way this Reichian focus on, and the important thing to me, it's the concept of form. I mean, you can say about what was the Roy Schaefer, an American analyst, said that it was how was the story told, how is things expressed, that's the form, the formal, not the content. We are used to listen. When you interpret a dream, it's the content of the symbols, associations, and so on, which is, of course, still very central, but it's also the way in which the person speaks, intonation, gestures, mimics. So this is the formal element. So that's the concept of character, which is a global sort of unit of analysis, if you want. It's the attitude, of the person sort of condenses his whole being, you could say. And we say relational oriented character analysis is to emphasize that when you think of character, you see one person which is with his intrapsychic dynamic and the balance and so on, an arrogant way of defending yourself in a way, but it's a one person in a way perspective. So we emphasize that this attitude, this also is communication. I mean, it's a relational. It's a relational message. If you come in with an arrogant attitude, to use that example, it's a relational message to say it that way to the other person. So it's to emphasize both. That aspect.
So in the book, you actually use the terminology of drama, of dramatization, of like the analyst providing a stage on which some of this of the characteristical specifics of the analyst or the patient can be performed in a way, and then to analyze that and the position of the analyst to be an observer at the same time as a participant in the drama, right?
Yes. Maybe we use the concept of relational scenario, which is which is a way, of course, of speaking of transference. We think a useful concept to capture how the, yes, it's a good way you say it, how the patient actualizes his or her object relation, inner object relations scenarios, actualize them in the transference to the analyst. Yes.
I think what is really I think it's very the form over content, or form and content focus is really important to the book. I think that's a very central part of it, and I think it's also in the title. Listening for the subtext
Yes.
Is exactly that, right? The subtext is the form that the narrative is expressed in. And I think this also comes with a certain idea of the analyst, how the analyst's attitude has to be in order to be able to catch the form, so to say, or to become aware of the form. And if I may, I'd like to quote a short passage from the book in which you describe the analyst, because I think it's such a vivid description of your image of the analyst. You say, the analyst is seated in her chair, quietly anticipative. She's in no hurry. There's nothing that has to be achieved. She does not charge the situation with her temper. On the contrary, she's turned towards the other, listening attentively, present in the contact, though with no traces of intimacy or fervency. She's fairly soft-spoken, yet clear and factual. A benevolent, lightly questioning tone characterizes her voice. No gestures, no jargon, no implicit jokiness, no sideward glances, no hidden implications. She upholds simplicity of words and expressions. I think this image really sums up the position of the analyst in your thinking. And what jumped out at me in the first reading was with no traces of intimacy or fervency. And I think that is something that many people will stumble over. Why do you think it is important for the analyst to be, like it says, without traces of intimacy or fervency in the consulting room?
Yes, it strikes me when you read it in English that the word intimacy, I'm not quite sure how it the connotations for an English
right.
speaking analyst, because what this image of the analyst is also an analyst with warmth. That's a word that's it's important, I think. It's no, but intimacy, as it is meant from our part, is to be. That's difficult to explain. It's no flirtation, no trying to seduce in any way, not to be overly warm, or it's I think it's our way of rendering the concept of neutrality, which I think is we use the word technical neutrality to as one aspect of the analytic attitude. But maybe that is the discussion you're referring to, is it? Sort of the discussion with a more relational kind of psychoanalytic thinking, is that?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nubooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think that's a very important part in a book, and a really good part of the book, actually. I think that's, yeah, if you could say more about that, because I like when you were just talking about the analyst in a way getting too close, being flirtatious, being so much in the enactment that the observer position gets lost.
Yeah.
I think that is something that also comes in the chapter in which you deal with epistemological questions about co-creation, right, and about co-construction. Mm. And maybe you could say a bit more about your position as opposed to an intersubjective or relational psychoanalytic perspective.
Yes. Yes, let me first say that I will credit the relational, it's also a big term, but let's keep with that
right.
Relational tradition, Mitchell, Stephen Mitchell, who was a central person. We argue a bit with him, I think, in the book, but the strength of their way of formulating the analytic encounter is to emphasize that the analyst is a participant in a dialogue. I mean, that some of Freud's ways of characterizing the analytic attitude may be, he was more of the sort of, he underlined the observer position in a way that we have to modify a bit, and we say in the book that we use the word stimulus value. I don't know how that reads in English, but I, mm-hmm. of course, me being a woman in a certain age with such and such characteristics and so on, I will have a different stimulus value than you or other. So I have to reflect, I have to be aware of that and be open to analyze to what in what way I specifically impact on my patient.
Right.
At the same time, I think it's epistemologically important to keep idea of our of us being observers. So it is the patient's drama that is brought into the our therapy room. I mean, with the concept of co-creation that they launch, you sort of lose the thought or the concept of the patient's patterns, relational patterns and character patterns and so on. I mean, even if I it will influence the dialogue with my patient in specific ways, and you will have another way, maybe we can, in my opinion, we can agree on potentially be in agreement about characterizing how these patient's patterns are.
Right.
So I attended a conference some years ago where there was a panel of some of the central relational analysts, and they one of them argued that with the concept of co-creation, as a consequence, you lose the concept of transference. For if everything
right.
is a real interaction, there is no there is no point from which you can observe in a way what is repeated from the patient's
part. Right. It's either nothing or everything is transference. Like it's, yeah. The concept loses meaning in that context,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, it does, yes. So in that sense of intersubjectivity, it's a position where you you lose the possibility of thinking of the patient's material and of the more, in a way, scientific position of the psychoanalytic personality theory, I think. But that's right. A different concept of intersubjectivity than that of Daniel Stern, for instance, which speaks of intersubjectivity as a developmental phase of the child's interaction with his parents. Just to say the word intersubjectivity, I mean, it's a central word also within developmental psychology, which is a different sense of intersubjectivity than the more epistemological sense which we are speaking.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's a big umbrella term for a lot of very different meanings. But I think what I'd like to focus on from what you just said, I think this upholding of transference as a central concept also kind of leads us back to, I think, a focus you have on the patient's history, but not in a narrow sense, not in the sense of biographical history, but more of a sense of, like you were saying before, embodied history, affective history that is played out in the consulting room. And I think what I would like to refer to here about the book is your differentiation between conflict on the one hand and deficit on the other hand as psychopathological agents, you could say. Could you talk a bit about that differentiation in your thinking?
Yes, that is a very central distinction that was introduced by my colleague. I had to honor him. he published an article in the International Journal in 1989 called Conflict and Deficit Implications for Technique, where the concept of conflict is a more psychological, developmental psychological way of speaking about pathology, which is more in line with the psychoanalytic way of thinking than the diagnostic way. That's an alternative when you speak of different, like Kernberg, different levels of personality organization. That's another way, which may have its merits maybe, but here you sort of focus on its deficit is in it's it refers actually to two aspects. There may be a deficit in the environment when we think of a child needing specific kind of affective interaction with his caregivers, which is a central theme in all developmental research developmental research. Affect mirroring, Peter Fonagy, his research group, I mean, the affect attunement, Daniel Stern, Bowlby's concept of emotional availability, a lot of concepts connoting different aspects of what kinds of environment the child needs. This is very, very condensed and very short. But there may be deficits in that, which results in sort of deficits in the structuring of personality. So, an important implication of that concept is when the person is structured on this more with it's never either or. I mean, all of us have sort of parts of us who are more in deficit and also there is also conflict. So there's no either or. That's an important thing to say. But the important technical point is and which I think is one of the contributions of Bjørn Schillingmo first, and which we continue in our common this book that we are talking about here, is that when the person is in this existential deficit mode of being, he or she is not in a psychological position to profit from more interpretational kind of interventions, which is our classical psychoanalytic tool, so to say. So the concept right. of affirmation, which Thiering Mo also introduced and which we develop further also in the book, is very central to my analytic clinical thinking, I will say, which affirmation is another mode of intervention, like I said, which refers to the affirmation of the validity of the subjective feeling of the patient.
Right. I think that is very important. And I think that is a point that is really like novel and I think really has to be underlined here. And I think for the listening audience, it would be really important to hear like an example maybe of how a patient who is more in a, because you were saying it's not either or, it's not either deficit or conflict, but you have this description of patients who are in a more deficit based, I don't know, situation, problem yeah, at yeah. the moment of coming into the consulting room. How would you describe that? What is the feeling like of being with a patient who suffered from developmental deficits?
Yeah, he or she might be, in a way, not aware that, let's say that my patient experienced me as rejecting, and with a patient on a more neurotic level, he will let some part of himself be aware that this is his projection in a way, that I'm not necessarily all rejecting. So it is analyzable in a way. Whereas a more deficit level patient will feel that I am. There's nothing to analyze in a way. He's not. He feels that I am rejecting. In a way, right. I mean, the Peter Fonagy's concept of mentalization, the ability, it's parallel to that in a way, that there is, you can have an alliance with the patient potentially about sort of seeing how, what it was that made him, she, him or her feel that she felt rejected, so it's this distinction of if you can the as if sort of aspect of your own, that you can see that your representation of the other person is your representation.
Right.
But I would
right.
think I would think I would maybe it would be useful if I gave an example of what
right
affirmation may be, and I like to use the example that Thiering Mo uses when he introduces. He wrote also an article called Affirmation, also in the International Journal, 1995, I think. And there he uses gives an example from a film by Ingmar Bergman, where you meet a woman who has in a hospital. She has tried to commit suicide and she's been saved, and she wakes up in this hospital and she's in a state of turmoil, inner turmoil, and there is a friend, good friend, sitting at the bedside, and she is sort of in the same state of mind, you imagine, that made her want to end her life, making her desperate. And she's sort of talks a lot about her upbringing, her parents, and ends in a climax saying, "Well, isn't it astonishing that grown-up people can shut a child, a lock, maybe that is the word, lock mm-hmm. a child into a wardrobe?" which is The Trauma of Bergman, by the way. Mm-hmm. Isn't it astonishing? And then the friend says very calmly, yes, that is astonishing. And she, you can see in the picture in a way that she calms down. And she, that is, there is a, affirmation is defined as that you remove a doubt. I mean, is and that's, we know as clinicians, that's how children experience things, that if they are punished, I mean, that's an old, most parents don't do that now, but I mean, previously there was a kind of punishment when you said you had to be locked up in your room to get, until you calm down or things like that, and of course, very potentially traumatic, I would say. But children will feel, well, when something can, if someone can do something like that to me, it must be something with me. There is a doubt.
Right.
There is a doubt in you, which is a kind of existential doubt, and yeah, so. The affirmative comment or intervention removes that doubt. It states, well, grown-up people shouldn't do that. That's the implication.
Right.
So the, it's a statement about reality in a way, about what is, what, which is a very different approach than the interpretation where you interpret something more unconscious, people's own share in a situation. Here you just affirm the validity of the experience, which and the the result or the consequence or the of the affirmative intervention is that the person feels that he's seen, he's understood, he's legitimate, his response is legitimate, accepted.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think it's really important to point out that in the book, you also give example, like all throughout the book are examples of situations with patients, with analysis.
Yeah.
I think that's a really strong point of the book.
Yeah, thank you.
And, the part...
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And especially in the chapter of affirmation, I think it really comes out that this is not a blunt intervention. This is not something that, you know, you just tell the patient, yeah, what you feel is valid. But you say, for example, also you give an example where silence can be an affirmation, right? Just listening to an experience for the first, like, or having an experience listened to for the first time can be very affirming.
Mm.
And I think that's a really important point. This is not, you know, not just telling the patient, yeah, what you feel is valid, but just being in the moment with the patient.
Yeah, that's important.
I would like to focus a bit more, because you were talking about the aims of the affirmative interventions as having the patient or removing doubt from the patient's experience. I think another thread running through the book is kind of its allegiance or your allegiance to kind of an enlightenment view of the individual, right? Because there are all these points in which you point out that, you know, actually the aim of analysis is to make possible the highest possible degree of autonomy for the individual.
Mm.
Is that something you would ascribe to?
Yes, it's interesting that you emphasize that. My doctoral thesis, which was written in Norwegian way back, was on the concept of autonomy. Yes, that's been important, and I think that's implied in the in the in in the classical psychoanalytic thinking, which we will emphasize that the aim of the treatment is to help the patient to gain more agency. So there's a more a concept that has become popular and more autonomous.
Right.
Yes, which is of course it's important to define what you mean by autonomy. I mean, it's not in being autonomous. It's not in opposition to being to feeling attached
right.
to other people or even dependent on your partner. These are words that are often put as opposites which are so it's important to define it in the right sense, that it means the ability to sort of feel that you are an agent in your own life, to, if you can put it that way.
Right.
And
right.
To feel free. Freedom is a very it's in a way in a simple word and a very profound word also, to feel free to. I can say to my patient when he or she tells me that I was did so and so, and when he said, and I said, can comment, well, it seems that you felt very unfree. That I don't know if you say that in English, but I mean, the freedom to be open, to be direct, to be to speak directly to the persons that are close to you, and without too much. I noticed that you quoted our way of describing the analyst, the word simplicity.
Right.
It was there, and simplicity is a good word.
And I think this kind of brings us back to the part of freedom in expression as well, right? I mean, the freedom to free associate is something that is very central to the endeavor, and sometimes this has to develop in the consulting room. And one thing that I found really interesting in the book is that you talk about the Rorschach test a few times, how you use it, and I think this is actually part of it, right? You kind of test the analysis, the patient's degree of freedom in describing the images. And I thought that was really interesting. I'm not familiar with the Rorschach that much, but I found the way that you use it really, really interesting in that sense, in kind of testing the level of ego functioning, in the sense of how free is a patient to talk about the experience of looking at this image.
Yes, Rorschach is a marvelous method. I mean, it's a strong tradition within psychoanalysis. With Roy Schaefer, among other people, who use the use of Rorschach in this specific psychoanalytic tradition of seeing it's a projective situation. That's the
right
analogy to the psychoanalytic situation, which is also a projective situation where there is no, you're told to, as you say, to say whatever comes to mind. In a way, it's no structure, and the way the person chooses to structure the situation, what he chooses to say, not to say, that's what you study in the Rorschach. Bjørn Killing was a master of interpreting Rorschach. That was really it's a kind of art to and it's a method that where you you capture the underlying organizational, the way the person organizes his perception, his thinking, and also the unconscious mind projected right. into the images that are unstructured, as you say.
Right. I was wondering, like, just to bring the conversation back to the deficit conflict differentiation, because I was wondering, and this is sort of a broader question, I was wondering if in the description of a patient coming in with a more deficit-based psychopathology, the description will jump out at every clinician right away, because we see these patients, right? Patients who are very repetitive in stating their problems, their needs, right? This is very something that needs satisfaction, sort of, in a way. And also the view of themselves as victims often.
It's important.
And I was wondering if there isn't a subtext here in the book of cultural criticism. Because what we're confronted with in the culture, not just in the consulting room, but in the culture, are a whole number of people from all different walks of life stating, I am a victim. Yeah. And I think a big part of your technique is to turn the passive into the active in treatment, right? Saying, okay, maybe my biography has something to do with me. And I think in that there's cultural criticism.
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you point out that, emphasize that, because I think it's very central to our thinking, to my thinking, that what you can do help people is to help them sort of realize their own share, I mean, in their relational problems, say. I mean, you can't change other people. So I comment on that every session, I would say. People
right.
want to say, well, he's... he speaks of your husband. He says, I shall do so and so. And so you let him decide, you let him get a hold on you. I mean, you point to your own share. That's helping people to increase their own agency. I mean,
right.
And even if people were victim, you can say that a child may be victim, or you may be victim of something, but what you deal with in psychoanalytic therapy is the way the person has constructed, organized what has happened to them.
Right. Well, Siri, we have been talking for the duration of a psychoanalytic hour, and I think it's time to bring this to a close. I would like to thank you very much for talking with me today, and I think this conversation will be of real interest to our audience. Just before we end, maybe you'd like to tell us what you're working on at the moment, and if we can expect maybe another book, or what kind of papers are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, my most recent article was an article I called The Otherness of Sexuality. Exploring the conflicted nature of drive and object choice. So that has been an issue which I used to work with when I was younger, and which has come back to me. So now I'm working on a book in Norwegian on this inherent conflicted nature in us, between, on the one side, the drive, I mean, the passion, the seeking for lust and excitement, and the other need, fundamental need for attachment and something familiar, which we call a base or a home. And of course, in my clinical practice and I mean in life, you see a lot of people who struggle with sort of uniting the two needs. So that's my most recent project. Yes.
Oh, this should be really interesting. I hope it gets translated to English so we can have another conversation. That'd be really nice.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Siri.
Yeah, thank you for asking me to come.
Sure. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah. And yeah, maybe we'll get to talk again
Yes.
some other time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.